Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello, my name is Pascal Nzabonimpa. I am from Rwanda, East Africa, and I now live in Greensboro, North Carolina, and I was a sponsor kid for 11 years through the Compassion Project when I was living back in Rwanda from 1984 to 1995. I moved here in December 1st, 1997 with my family, escaping the genocide in Rwanda, and I've been living here since then. And I'm here to share my testimony of wonderful and incredible thing that Jesus Christ has done in my life, of course, through compassion and through the people that cared, through the church that sponsored me for 11 years, Sutton Ellen Baptist Church. Okay, now I start, I guess. I grew up in a small village in Rwanda, about this 25,000 people. Most of the people there worked as farmers, 99%. My dad also was a farmer in other people's farm, not in our farm because we didn't have one, in other people's farm. And his pay would be whatever that he would found left in a farm. So meaning, if they had planted potato in a farm and they took it out, when it was time to plow the ground again, my dad would be that guy that would plow the ground, and his pay would be whatever that he would found that was left in the ground. And that would be his pay. And majority of the time, my dad would wake up early in the morning, go and work, and about 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, depending whatever time he came home, we saw him coming home, and one of the things that used to crush us, it was because he would be, you know, as soon as he came inside, he would be empty-handed. For us, empty-handed, it meant a night of starvation ahead of us, because, mind you, we had been waiting all day for him to bring us something to eat home, and there he was, empty-handed. And so, sometime we just even started, you know, me and my sibling, we just started out busting out laughing, you know, knowing the pain we were going to face again in the middle of the night, because we slept in one small bedroom, Serengeti mat divided our parents' room and our room, and so all of us just slept on a mat, you know, our legs touching the ground, and so, you know, we would sleep there aware of, you know, each other's actions. You know, you will hear toasting, turning, kicking, whatever you could imagine of, waking up in the middle of the night, you know, sometimes staying up all night, tying our stomach so we can mash our stomach together and so not to feel pain, you know, doing all the kind of things, you know. The night will pretty much seem like it will never end. Because at least during the day, you got to be able to go to fetch water, you got to be able to walk around. By the night, you was just confined in that one place where you was just going to face the whole night, and the pain was endurable. And that was not that the story of just our own household. It was the story pretty much of the whole neighborhood, because as we would found out, in Africa, when you cook, people know. So sometime they will be cooking, and you will see the smoke coming out of the huts, and the parents will, you know, kick the kids out of the house, say, go and find out, see if they're eating anything. And majority of the time, when your parents send you to a neighbor to see if they have anything to eat, you will go and find out they're just cooking water or just gathering around the fire, you know, cooking nothing, and come back home and just sit there and, you know, just starve to death, I guess. Sometime we would have food at my house, like on a special occasion, and because it would be, you know, every now and then, you know, not enough, the kids would fight over who would lick the last food off the plate. And so our parents, to be able to solve the problem, they would assign us the days in which you would lick the plate. And so they would say, you know, like, I, you know, we had 10 kids, so, you know, you have to wait 10 days before it came to you. And that was a long wait because it was pretty much like Christmas, like, you know, when it came your time to lick the plate. You will have in mind the day, your day that you was going to lick the plate. And one of the things, you know, I still remember is, you know, the eyes as my siblings stared at me, or how we stared at the other kids as they were having the plate on their face, licking it, you know. And I don't know how many households lick plates in America, and I don't think I have licked any plate since I've been in this country. So, you know, taking turns to lick plates, you know, in special occasions, sometimes, you know, going on days without eating. We had a small, my stepmom had planted tomatoes around the house, which we watered. And so every now and then when it'd be going on, you know, a little while without having any food, they would take a tomato and slice it and put it in a pot full of hot water, and you bring your cup for dinner and lunch, and that's pretty much what you eat. But, you know, that water wouldn't stay in your stomach for a little while. It was, you know, it was miserly. But in 1984, compassion showed up at my house. And, I mean, not at my house. It was almost at my house. That's how I felt. At my school, and sponsored the whole classroom that I was in. We was the first kids that was sponsored. They came and took pictures. Some kids ran away because they have never seen a white person before, and they thought there was, you know, there was a rumor that they was going to take pictures and so share our spirits, you know. It was stupid. No matter. But, yeah. But, you know, they went and took our picture and found us sponsors. My sponsor was a whole church from the United Kingdom, Sutton Ellen Baptist Church. And that was pretty much the only word in English I knew how to say. Damn, you know. You can't tell that 1997 I didn't even speak at least this much English. The only thing I knew was hello and okay. But now I have came far away to learn how to speak. Which is wonderful because, you know, how else would I be able to give my testimony? But, you know, Sutton Ellen Baptist Church, they sponsored me for 11 years. And the letters that they wrote to me, it was one of the most incredible things that I ever had. You know, it's not like here when you get, you know, you get letters, you know, we don't have post office in my country. So the letters that I got from my sponsor was the only letter I ever got. And I slept with them, you know, we, you know, led them, you know. I remember at school when kids used to gather around me, you know, just to lead to them, you know, tell them a letter that came from far away, you know, from my sponsor, you know. Started telling me that, you know, I was gonna be somebody, that, you know, I mattered to God, that, you know, I wasn't meant for nothing, that God knows about my existence, you know. And when somebody tell you things like that, and you come to believe it, and their action also, you know, also of course helped to believe it, you know. Started going to church. I was in Compassion Choir, was in Compassion Soccer Team, was in Compassion Volleyball Team, Compassion Choir that went around the village, singing throughout the village, you know. And these kids, you know, I'm sorry, no offense, but I think our choir was better than your choir. Just kidding. I mean, we would sing our heart out. The dust in that, you know, our church wasn't paved. So we would dance at that church, and the dust would rise to the roof, you know, because of the joy that we had, because of how, you know, coming from believing nothing to coming to get to know Jesus Christ and knowing that you were now in Jesus' hand and that he wasn't going to allow us to suffer any longer. And so we sang around, you know, the village, competing with some other compassion project around the village, you know. Compassion changed us, you know. We were called the chosen one in our village. At the local project, you know, we cooked there sometime. We went there like Wednesday in the afternoon and Saturday in the afternoon. We helped other younger kids to write their letters to their sponsors. We pretty much did everything there. You know, we hung up there. We had rabbits. We took a trip around the country. And oh, and another thing, we would take field trip, and which was pretty much the first time any one of us have ever got it in a car, you know. Otherwise, then we would see probably a car pass by, like, every, you know, like maybe one car every month, and then we got to get in one, and we sang through the hallway. Probably about, I would say about maybe 300 miles, singing the whole time. By the time we reached the destination, no one in our car had any voices, you know. And of course, we was covered in a dust because we were in a pickup truck, but we didn't care about that, you know. We was praising God, you know, we was praising Jesus Christ, you know, singing all songs in the books, you know, and, you know, we pretty much knew all the songs in our hymn book, you know. We didn't use the books like you guys do here, you know. We had pretty much memory because we sang it every Sunday. We sang it in our choir. So, you know, you could see the change in a small village as the people brought, you know, the main transportation in Rwanda is bicycles. And so at the Compassion Project, they taught us how to make shoes. I made my own shoes from the tires when I was 14. Learning was taught how to fix bicycles. And the people in our village will bring the bicycles to their local project to be fixed. The girls were neat. They were making our own school uniform. They would, you know, like we used to say, we was marching to the paradise, you know, to us, because we had been given something that we never had before, that no one in our village had, and that was hope, that was soul, that was Jesus Christ. We were ministered to, you know, given my first Bible when I was 6 years old, and, you know, being taught in school how to read it, you know, they have changed our world from nothing to full revival. We felt human. That's one of the sentences that I used to describe how we really felt. Because they are on when you wake up in a village where there is no hope, where people continue to die every day, where there is no way out, where you see no way out, where you know that sooner or later, it's a tragic that waiting to happen, that you're going to end up as the neighbor's kids, or you're going to die, you know. And we were given hope, changed our life, which is one of the things I think to me was a life-changing to me, because that's one of the things that had helped me to be able to deal with the genocide in 1994. In 1994 in Rwanda, the genocide started. There was a civil war and a genocide together between the two tribes of Rwanda. We had three tribes in Rwanda, but it was between the two tribes. 85% was Hutu. I mean, 84% was Hutu, and 15% was Tutsi. And April the 6th, 1994, the president's plane was shut down, and the next day, the chaos started. People started being killed for nothing. Neighbors going to the neighbors and take them. And most of them, one of the things I think you can credit to, it's because of the poverty and the starvation that people had. So there was so much looting that they would kill the people, take out the windows, take out the doors, take out everything that was in the house. That's, you know, one of the things that, you know, benefit that the killers had to get. And so a month later, May 12, 1994, we left home because the genocide have left our home. By the time we left home, at least 15,000 of the 25,000 people had been already killed by the laborers. They will walk in a group with machete, dealing daylight. It was nothing that was, it wasn't hidden, dealing daylight, going to the people's houses, you know. And one of the things that you really can't comprehend is, you know, how does a human being go and take another human's life? And that was something that was being done by pretty much the majority of the people. The women was, if they wasn't killing, they was yelling, telling the killers where the people was hiding, you know. And so May 12th, we left home, packed, you know. Of course, we had packed a month earlier because we've been hearing bomb exploding in the distance. So we took things like blanket pads, and for the first time, we left home, you know, living, you know, with all of us. My dad wasn't with us because he was now, because Compassion relieving him of his responsibility. He has left the village and went to work in Kigali. And so by the time we left home, my dad wasn't with us. And we will go on for 3 years without knowing where he was, thinking that he was dead for 3 years. And so we left on our own without a dad, heading west, walking from morning to dawn, for about 3 months. By the time we reached the west coast of Rwanda, our feet had swollen, We hadn't taken a shower. Only shower we got was from the rain that rained throughout May in our time, for 3 months not having a shower, not changing clothes, being facing killer every day, because every 3 to 4 or 5 miles you pass, there was roadblocks where the killer was waiting for people there with machete that was dripping blood. And one of the places we got about halfway to June, it was one of the places my mother was Tutsi and my father was Hutu, and it was one of the places where I got to. And as soon as they saw me, they say he's a cockroach, just don't let him go. And they sat me and confined me to that chair and said, sit here, you know, waiting pretty much to die. They didn't have enough people, so there were people who were taking identification from the people through the lines of the people that was passing by. And the other killer was taking people to kill them. Even the flies that was flying around smelled of death, because of course they had been feeding from the bodies of the people throughout the whole time. And I was sat on a chair pretty much just waiting to die. My family was kicked away and chased away by the people, by the Interahamwe, the thugs. And so I sat there for a few minutes. Of course, it felt like forever. I can't really, pretty much, I have tried to estimate how much time I spent on a chair, but I can never pretty much figure out how long I was on a chair, but I figure it was for a quiet while. And so, before the killer could come back, there was a soldier that my dad had helped put in school. His name was Teogen. He had helped put in school. And last time I saw him, I think I was 11 years old, and now I was, you know, 15 and a half, turning 16, not quite 16 yet. And so he said, I know this boy, please let him go. And they let me go. And the funny thing is, he had sold his gun. They could have said no, and there is nothing else he could have done. He could have just got up and left, and then, because, you know, there is nothing he could have done. And they let me go. As soon as we got in the truck they were driving, we could see the killers coming back with the machete, finished killing the other people that I was killing, you know. And as soon as we got in the truck started driving away. You could see them coming in the distance, chasing the truck, saying, you know, why are you letting that cockroach go? And as soon as, you know, as the truck was speeding away and the dust rising away, you know, I was realizing that, you know, I was farther and getting away from death, you know, falling, getting away. You know, it's something that, you know, you really don't understand until you come close to being killed, you know. It's one of those things that you realize, you know, there was no way I was lucky. There is no way this was luck. This was Jesus Christ. The same way he sent the Church of Sutton Baptist Church to come save me. And so we left there and went to the border of Congo and Rwanda, lived in refugee camp for about 6 months. There was about 3 million refugees in those camps. People dying every day from anything that you can think of. Imagine even through the camps, there was still the Interahamwe going through there and still trying to pick up people to kill them, you know. And we left there and went to Uganda. From Uganda, we went to Kenya, where we would spend the next 2 years in refugee camps, being fed every day from measuring cups, where you'll be given, if you have 5 people in your family, they will give you 5 cups, and it was supposed to last you for a week or 2 weeks, but it will be done in 1 week, and you know, pretty much you'll be left to fend for yourself. And so we lived there for about 2 years, and in 1997, that's when the news got to us that my dad was still alive. For 3 years, we had no idea where he was. People had told us that, you know, they saw him being shot execution style. And those were things that you heard from, you ask for somebody, what happened to this person? You tell you that you see him being killed, or he was shot and this, you know. And so we kind of believed it for about 3 years. And, you know, we were pretty much trying to forget about him. And then in 1997, the news got to us that my dad was alive and he was living in Greensboro, North Carolina. And he got out of the genocide through embassy of Tanzanian embassy. They came to pick up their citizens, and my dad disguised himself as a foreigner. And that's how pretty much he left Rwanda. And he left Rwanda, went to Tanzania, and went to to Kenya. And in the summer of 1994, when the genocide was in its last tour, my dad was given asylum by the United States government. And he came to the United States. And the funny thing is, you know, when he arrived in the United States, he applied for us to come to the United States, even though for about 3 years or so, he had no idea where we were. And in 1997, we was approved to come to the United States, you know, totally different country than pretty much anything we had seen, you know. People used to say that the United States was heaven, you know. I wouldn't say it's heaven, but it's close to that comparing to where we have came from, you know. I remember the first time we came, we went to the Food Lion, you know, all kinds of food. We were looking like we just came from a planet, like we were like aliens, you know, and anything to us was as surprising as staring at the TV, thinking there was little people in the TV, seeing moving doors, thinking that there was somebody hiding behind them and opening at the door every time they saw us, you know, coming up and backing up, you know, things like that. Thinking that there was a little man that was giving money away from the ATM machine. A lot of things was, you know, to us, culture shocking, as much as turning on stoves in our house, and we didn't even know how to turn it on. But the first thing they taught us when we were in Kenya, that if you ever come in America and you have trouble, all you have to do is dial 911 and say fire, emergency, or police. And that time, I think we dialed the 911 and we called the fire. We say fire and the police and the ambulance and the fire truck showed up. We thought we were going to jail, and you know, it's one of the things that to us it's, you know, amazing how things works here, you know, because in Rwanda you don't get sick and call the hospital. You know, the hospital is 2 days away. People, they used to carry people on a mat with four handles, and they would carry you for 2 days to the hospitals, you know. And people do die in a way to the hospitals. People don't have a chance to be able to go to like CVS, pharmacies, and buy medicines like people do here. So there is so many things that, you know, that is, I'm grateful, because of course I enjoy it today too. Whenever I have a headache, I can go to a 7-Eleven, get pills, you know, and that's something that we don't have in Rwanda. So to me, it's a totally different world, and you know, it calls for pity and to want to help those who are helpless, because pretty much they count on you guys. They count on those who can help. Because right now my sister in Rwanda, I know she counts on me because I'm living in the United States. She doesn't know that, of course, sometimes I have to work two jobs and go to school, but at least I have the opportunity to be able to do that. Even though as much as I might complain about working those two jobs, I know I won't starve, I know I won't die because I'm able to do that. One of the things I always say, even the homeless in this country have it better than the people where I am from, because there is no such thing as shelter. There is no such thing as, you know, a place where you can go to eat. I spoke at one of the homeless shelter in Greensboro, and I remember asking them, before I spoke, I was like, you know, tell me one of the worst thing that ever happened to you. And I wanted to have an idea of, you know, what they experienced, you know. And one of the things that shocked them is that, you know, I think every Wednesday and Saturday they have chicken. And in Rwanda, at least maybe in 3 to 4, 5 years, 1 year you will have chicken on Christmas. Because, you know, of course, you know, chicken is expensive there. And one of the things I always say is that the chicken there tasted a lot better than chicken in this country. But then it sure does when you have it once a year. It does taste better than, you know, any other things, you know. So there is so many things to be grateful to in this country. There's so many things that, you know, that goes on, you know, unseen. There's so many things that you're not able to see, but, you know, the main thing is that, you know, anybody can help anybody in this country. Anyone can help anybody from where I am from in Rwanda. You know, other people might think that, you know, the little thing I do, it doesn't make a difference. You know, it's so simple. If it wasn't for compassion, I have no doubt I'd be gone, unless God would have found some other way to bring somebody else in my life. But otherwise, I would have died in Rwanda. This stage would be empty, because, you know, that's the way it is in Rwanda. You know, it's evidence, you know, through the neighbors. You know, there was this lady from Magadalena. I also left her to her every now and then. She lost 9 of her kids And the last one that was left, she was killed during the genocide. And they all, you know, one of the things I remember growing up is because every now and then they'll have a funeral of her kids. And nine of, you know, her kids died. And, you know, of course nobody knew I was killing the kids, but, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize, you know, living in a village in a hut where she had nine kids, no food. Sooner or later they're gonna end up dying. And so, you know, even though as we sit here right now, even though as you see me and telling you all the miracles that has happened to me, there is somebody who would not get a chance to have that kind of miracle happen in their life, and they count on you to be able to change them, you know. So if you can't sponsor a kid, you know, you might wonder, you know, maybe I it's so many that I can't change the whole world, but you can change the world of one child as it has been done to me. Of course, I have meant my sponsors to tell them how they have changed my life, but one of my dreams is to hope that one day I'm going to be able to meet them and let them know how much they have changed and how much they have done in my life. And most of them, they had, you know, able me to be able to get to know Jesus Christ and know that, you know, I'm guaranteed a place in heaven, that, you know, I won't only endure the suffering in this world, but there is a better place that is waiting ahead of me. So thank you for allowing me to come here and share my testimony. Sorry I talk too much, because I know I tend to do that a lot. But I just want to say thank you so much, and God bless you.